When I was just a tyke, cowboy actors were marketed as role models for little backyard cowpokes like me. And we could send off to get a certificate making us pals of the saddle or some such with Roy Rogers, Hopalong Cassidy, or others. Cute for a 4-year-old. Less so for 57-year-old Jeff Spaceboy Bezos. Yet, the gabillionaire profiteer, labor exploiter, and tax scofflaw who heads the Amazon online retail syndicate was all dressed up in July, play-acting as a heroic conqueror of space. Little Jeff took an ego trip on his very own rocket ship, publicizing it as some combination of Wright Brothers innovation and Apollo moon landing. But the whole thing took only 11 minutes, barely made it to space, achieved no scientific purpose, and did zero to enhance American prestige in the world. As for personal genius or heroics, Bezos didn't invent or build the spacecraft, didn't have any role in flying it, and he faced no cosmic unknowns. He didn't even have to wear a spacesuit. All he really did was to buy the spacecraft. But he did get to dress up in a sort of space-style jogging outfit with his name and his corporate logo emblazoned on it. Then, like a little boy getting a cereal box certificate proclaiming him a cowboy, when the diminutive mega-billionaire floated back to terra firma, he held a fake ceremony at which some former NASA official pinned a set of phony astronaut wings on him. More pathetically, his corporate lobbyists are said to be appealing to Washington officials to award official astronaut wings for what amounted to a rich man's carnival ride. This is Jim Hightower saying, so there you have the new pantheon of America's flight heroes, the Wright brothers, Amelia Earhart, John Glenn, and Jeff Spaceboy Bezos. Did I mention pathetic? The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So over the weekend on our show on WBAI in New York City, we were talking about, you know, in the city, the organizing that's going on. And there are a couple of groups that are just organizing like crazy. And one of them is the News Guild, the CWA union, who has been, you know, just organizing these digital newsrooms and these magazines and all of these places, because for so long they haven't been organized and they've been exploitable. And now I think people are finally fed up. And we're in this moment. We're coming out of the pandemic. I believe people are saying, you know, I've had enough. It's time to get something for our labor. I'm tired of getting the short end of the stick. Which is why I thought it'd be a great idea to bring John Schlois on the program. John is the president of the News Guild, CWA, their union, like I said, like wildfire organizing. And here to share some thoughts on the success they have had. I've asked John to come talk with us. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick. Great to be here.
So let's start with congratulations. From everything I see, you guys are tearing it up in a time when, you know, especially with the last administration doing everything they can do to make it harder for people to organize, you guys have figured out a way of doing it.
Well, you know, it's probably a mixture of different things, but it's also like so much credit to the workers, right? Like all of a sudden you've got these like kind of new generation of workers who actually want to have a voice in their workplace. And so they're building up unions from places like Insider or Forbes to small publications in the past few years in places like Montana, the Billings Gazette, or in Wyoming, or in Idaho, like legitimately all over the country. And so it's been fantastic to see like thousands of workers. And in fact, in the last 4 years, we've had 5,700 new workers join our union, which is growth of 30%.
No, that's enormous, because considering, you know, to be honest, you guys were almost dead at one point. I mean, you know, there was this mass consolidation in the 90s that happened to the newspapers. A lot of them went under. There was big buyouts. And the first thing that they were doing is crushing contracts, just taking the name and centralizing the printing and all that and doing away with all those jobs. When I was a kid, the newspaper gig was a good-paying, family-sustained wage career job, and they've sadly destroyed the vast majority of those jobs. Now you guys are just picking back up and going, "Hey, we're gonna reorganize these people."
Yeah, you know, well, it's sort of funny. Even if you go back to the founding of the American Newspaper Guild back in the 1930s, you know, the problems were consolidation, low pay, no job security. So it's actually like it just keeps repeating itself. It's like, I don't know, the common thing that almost every American worker who's not in a union faces.
Yep.
And journalists are just fed up. So, like, you know, right now we've got just a handful of companies that own almost all of the newspapers across the country. Many of them are controlled by private equity and hedge funds. So in a lot of places, workers haven't received a raise in sometimes a decade or more. And they also don't have any job security. So they're like, what are we doing? Like, what we do as journalists is we go out and we cover the stories in our community. We tell the stories of our community for other people to understand how our democracy actually works and functions. And it's so shameful that these high paid executives at places like Gannett or Alden Global Capital, which owns Tribune Publishing, like the Chicago Tribune or the Denver Post through a media news group, another company that they own. It's so shameful for these high paid executives to just take all of the money and resources out of our company and give us just barely even crumbs. You know, Julie K. Brown just published a book 2 weeks ago. She's a reporter at the Miami Herald. She's a member of the News Guild they organized a couple of years ago, and she just published the book about how she blew open the Jeffrey Epstein story. And she couldn't even get basic expenses covered while she was doing her job, and she had to cover a lot of other stories while she was doing it. And at the same time, she couldn't even save for retirement because she didn't make enough money at the paper.
And that's insane. And a lot of the people I know who are in what is the new media, most of them are gig workers and don't even have employee rights. Which for me is another hurdle and obstacle that we have to figure out how to deal with. But it seems like, you know, again, you've got these big CEOs who figured out a way to reap all the benefits, while the people who are actually doing the work, they're the ones getting the short end of the stick, which is why, again, I'm always rooting for the little guy. I'm always rooting for the working people to come together and say, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not taking it anymore.
I had those feelings myself. I grew up in very rural Arkansas in a town called Harmony Grove. I did not come from a labor background. I didn't know anything about unions when I was a kid through most of my like young adult life. And then I landed at the Los Angeles Times, a place that in the newsroom had never had a union in its 130 plus years. And we had seen just cuts after cuts after cuts. We had seen changing management. We had seen they pulled away our accrued vacation. So we couldn't even accrue and take vacation anymore as an asset. And they kept changing all these things. And we were like, you know, this is crap. We need to stop this. And so we were like, well, how do we do that? And someone said, well, what about this union thing? That seems like a thing to do. And so we figured it out. And us with, you know, about 1,500 other journalists and other media workers and activists in 2018, built unions and joined the News Guild, our union.
No, it was a huge thing, and I remember talking about it back then, just going, "That's amazing!" And hopefully, it starts a wave of more people doing what you're doing. Because look, you're a young guy. Young guys and women are coming into this industry who, like you, sadly, know nothing about unions, no idea what they are, what they do, and what function they serve. So, you know, part of what I do and part of what I think is important, we need to educate people on what exactly unions are as opposed to what we're told they are. Because, yep. You know, you look at Amazon and the campaign that they ran. You look at this Washingtonian magazine. Their CEO, I guess, threw everything that they possibly could at the staff. You know, every, you know, anti-union meetings, calling, you know, staffers in one-on-one. You know, all of the shenanigans that Amazon just got slapped for, they're doing on this smaller level, because this is what employers have been getting away with for way too long.
Yeah, it's so funny that you bring up the Washingtonian. You know, it's a magazine here in D.C. And the workers actually took a one-day strike a couple of months ago after the CEO of the company posted an op-ed in the Washington Post basically saying, you know, if you don't come back into the office when we tell you to come back into the office, then you might as well, we're going to convert you to independent contractors. We're going to 1099 you. And the workers were like, that is so beyond disrespectful. They didn't have a union, but they took a strike. They struck, including middle managers. And so now those workers, it's not a huge number of people, but it's people who really are dedicated to like actually building a voice in their union. They're now organizing with the Guild here in DC. And you're right. I mean, this company, well, we have this saying in the labor movement, right, on the inside, that sometimes the boss is the best organizer. And this CEO is just burning money. treating her employees with such disrespect, you know, basically insulting their intelligence, right? And so, like, you know, one of the things that was, like, I thought was really inspiring was, you know, they send out these anti-union talking points. They send it out in the slide deck. It's like, we just want you to have the facts, and you need to do your research before you vote, you know, to join this union, because you need to know what you're doing here. And it's so insulting, because it's like every single day journalists do a ton of research. You don't think they did research on this union? Of course they did research on our union. That's what they do. And so it was such a waste of money. And, you know, it's kind of embarrassing at this point. But again, you know, sometimes the boss is just the best organizer, because they put their foot in the mouth and they push people along.
You know, it's frightening, though, you know, as you said that you come back to work, or you do what we say, or we're going to make you all independent mm-hmm. contractors. That's a threat. Under even our broken ossificated labor law, that's still against the law. That's still illegal. And yet, what penalties did she have to pay? None. Maybe had at worst had to post a notice saying, "I'm sorry, I won't do it again," until they do it the next time.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. I mean, it's why we actually need to have financial penalties, because, you know, you were talking earlier in the day about, you know, organizing. We've had this massive success. We are in the middle of more than 90 first contract fights right now in our union alone. That's so many. And so we're staffing up like wildfire to basically be able to pull people through that effort. But companies want to just drag it out. They don't care about actually reaching a deal. They don't really want to bargain in good faith. And they will violate the law every single way. In Idaho, you know, we've got 20 people in Idaho at the Idaho Statesman in Boise. And the company tried to implement page view quotas on them, basically demanding that they have to have a certain number of visitors to their stories on a certain amount of frequency of time. That's a violation of status quo. You know, for folks who know, like, after you organize, you get certified or voluntarily recognized as a union, the company can't change anything without negotiating with the union or the workers, right?
Right.
And they changed it by implementing that. And we fought. We went to the NLRB. They won, which was a huge victory. But, like, these companies should have huge penalties, financial penalties against them.
No, I'm with you. And this is where I keep coming back to. We need major comprehensive labor law reform. You know, I look at this Amazon story where evidently they're going to have to re-vote. I go, okay, big deal. They got to re-vote. They're going to spend a couple more $1 million to do exactly what they did, because there's no penalty. I think they should have been given union recognition right there on the spot. You begin negotiating, and we should have something in place that says, if you don't have something in a year, we're going to impose something.
Yeah, we'll go to arbitration. I mean, you know, the months that we waste fighting over just cause protections for jobs is absurd. Something that an arbitrator would award us like in a heartbeat. It would be so much better. And and I mean, that's, you know, that's part of what's in the PRO Act, which is great. Yeah, and the Amazon situation is really fascinating too. You know, I think it also comes down to the job that we have to do as organizers in this movement. We have to also do what you said earlier, right? It's not just about the social media. It's not about the glitzy campaigns or the sexy flyers. We got to knock on doors. We got to go call people up. We got to have one-on-one conversations. We need to figure out what their issues are, and we have to move them to action.
You're spot on. And a big part of that, John, is educating them. And educating them with good information, not some silly meme that they saw on Facebook. Not some Instagram post that who knows, maybe it came from Russia, maybe it didn't. You know, we need actual facts. And this is where, you know, real journalism, I think, is extremely important, in that you're held responsible and accountable for what you write. And you're professional in doing that, instead of having just some guy, you know, typing off, firing off anything to get the clickbait that evidently this company wanted. Yeah. Regardless of the facts, we need real journalism. And I think the only way we get to that at this point is with some government intervention. I don't know how we do that. Some funding, I'm not sure. And I know you guys are working on pushing a piece of legislation, the Local Journalism Sustainability Act. Can you explain what that is and what do you think it'll do?
Yeah, so it's actually kind of rarity. Usually, like, our union is pretty shy about engaging in politics, but we've seen a total devastation in the industry, losing local journalists across this country. And it has huge ramifications for our democracy, because when you lose local journalists, there are studies that show when you lose a local journalist in a smaller community or a mid-sized community, you don't have journalists watching what's happening at the city or county level or at the different, like, boards that are controlling your taxes or how much money they're spending. So taxes go up, corruption goes up, partisanship goes up, because people actually end up migrating to social media for their quote unquote news, and they end up only talking to people in kind of their bubble. So it has huge ramifications. And what we did is, in the last decade, since kind of the last recession, 2008, 2009, in that year, we've lost 36,000 journalists at the local level in this country. That's about half of the entire industry, which is absurd to lose half of an entire industry in a decade. So what we've done is we put forward some solutions. Last year, we won an expansion of the Paycheck Protection Program to be able to sustain jobs. Everything that we're trying to do is focused on jobs, because that's where we've been losing. And so this Local Journalism Sustainability Act, bipartisan, it had support in the House last year. It's been reintroduced in the House. And then last week was it reintroduced in the Senate by Maria Cantwell, and then sponsored by Senator Wyden. And that basically does like three things. One, it provides tax credit for subscribers so that they can get about $250 a year as a deduction. Not huge, not amazing. But the next thing that's really good is it actually provides some incentive to hold people onto their jobs. It provides several thousands of dollars every year for tax credits for companies to retain and hire journalists. Because everything that we're trying to do is really try to tie it to the job. So we're hopeful that something like that can actually be productive. But I think what you're talking about is actually something we have to really do, which is we have to replant all of the news industry back into local communities. Because right now, too many hedge funds, too many corporations control local news. And so we got to break it up. We got to make it responsive to our communities by providing incentives to start up new local nonprofit news organizations that are going to be mostly digital or mostly online, but actually cater the community and speak for the voice of the community and provide the stories that people actually want to see and aren't controlled by those hedge funds or huge conglomerations.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the downfall of our media structure. Look, we've been in these moments in this country before. I mean, you know, I'm not naive enough to think that, oh, this is the worst it's ever been. You go back to the days of yellow journalism and the Hearst papers and all that stuff of the past, the Hearst papers of the past. They were just as bad in their time. But I think we can be, I think learning the lessons of the past, learning about where we are right now, I think we could, I think we can do better.
I think so too. And I mean, like, you know, let's talk about the recent past. Like January 6th happened, there were thousands of people in our nation's capital who stormed into our house of democracy based on lies and fiction, right? That was able to spread because there weren't enough journalists, in my opinion, weren't enough journalists across the entire country to provide fact-based information. People lost all of that local news coverage. They don't have a voice. They don't see themselves represented in New York City or on cable news shows or on large platforms because they aren't part of that. And they've lost their local journalists. They just go online to 4chan and to some of these websites where they just believe all these conspiracy theories. It's a huge problem of media literacy in our country.
No, I'm there with you. So I go back to this Local Journalism Sustainability Act that you're advocating for. You're going to give the guy who's going to 4chan doing his, you know, his vaccine research with his mouth open watching YouTube, you're going to give him $250 to spend on media. You think he's going to spend it on the local, you know, Gazette, or is he going to spend it on crazy QRS?
Well, hopefully he's going to spend it on actual journalism. So we tried to define what actual journalists are doing in there, which is a little bit tricky, but tried to actually make it legitimate. And we also wanted to make sure that it was focused on local news so that it wouldn't just be going to like some of the larger publications. We represent workers at the New York Times, at the Washington Post, at the Wall Street Journal, really large publications. But the issue of losing local news is a matter of national import, because a lot of news stories end up starting out as local stories from the get-go. So I'm hopeful there. And I think too, like the other thing is providing a benefit for companies. And some of these are still owned by families or smaller companies. Newspapers of New England is a smaller company. You know, my paper that I cut my teeth on is the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, just recently purchased the Pine Bluff newspaper from Gannett, the largest chain in the country, turned it back to local ownership. So it's owned in Arkansas. It would be good to provide incentives to keep jobs for journalists at the local level. And that's a big chunk of that.
Yeah, ultimately, you know, the conversation I had in the last segment with J.D. Shulton, he's like, look, you antitrust laws play very, breaking up big conglomerates, breaking up these monopolies, play very well in urban areas and in rural areas, because nobody wants somebody too big to be accountable. I think our media structure, something most certainly has to be broken up and redistributed back to the local. And if any of my local reporters are listening, you should check out newsguild.org so that our local paper here can, the workers there can organize. And I highly encourage people to do that so that you have some voice on the job and you know who you are. But John, last question I've got for you, because look, there are a lot of places out there who, like you said, they don't know what a union is, have never ever thought about it. What's the elevator pitch to them?
You know, the question is whether you want to actually secure whatever you've got going on right now and try to build something better. If you want to have someone else completely control your workspace, including all the health and safety issues, including your pay, including whether you have a job or not, then yeah, don't have a union. But if you'd like to actually have a say in your workplace, then you should talk to your colleagues, because when you find you have conversations with your colleagues, you end up realizing that there are huge issues that are actually widespread. And then collectively, you can do something about it by building up a union, by building up a massive amount of support. And that just starts one conversation at a time. And you'll find those issues, whether it's retirement savings, it's healthcare, it's better pay. You can do that. And these companies are going to run you ragged if you don't actually stand up to them.
Yeah, it's about wages, hours, conditions, but also about your craft. As journalists, you want to have an even playing field, an even floor, so you can go out and do the work that you do and do it without fear of intimidation or reprisal or poverty. John, I appreciate the work that you do. Good on you. Good stuff. I hope you come back and share some more with you as you continue to rack up these wins.
Love to. And, you know, these wins belong to all of us because, you know, we are organizing a massive wave, you know, in at least media. But that's got to spread. We got to organize millions of workers across this country.
Good stuff, John. I appreciate it. John Schlois, president of the News Guild CWA. Check out their website, newsguild.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Would you want $250 a year to spend on local media? Would you do it? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day striking Teamsters in Minneapolis defied martial law. They stopped scab trucks, forcing the release of their strike leaders. Armed with bayonets and machine guns, the National Guard had patrolled the streets for nearly a week. They seized scores of strikers and union leaders and threw them into military stockades. Drivers were outraged. They defied Governor Olson and Major General Walsh, who, on behalf of the Citizens Alliance and trucking bosses, were determined to break the strike. Soon after strikers were imprisoned, drivers began chasing scab trucks across the city. Multiple reports poured in of picketers forcing trucks to stop. Some unloaded their cargo onto bridges. Others chased, captured, and damaged the scab trucks. Strikers ripped ignition wires out, forced scabs from the wheel, and then disappeared before police and the National Guard could arrive to retaliate. In just 3 hours, strikers had overturned nearly 70 trucks. Unable to stop the superior force of striking drivers, Bill Brown, Vincent, and Miles Dunn were ordered unconditionally released from the military stockades. Now, employers, the governor, and other strike-breaking agencies were eager to propose peace to federal mediators. But they proposed to scrap the terms of their earlier May agreement. In response, the leaders of Local 574 issued a general strike call. In it, they asked, quote, "Is there one man so blind as not to see that if 574 is allowed to go down to defeat under the brutal hammering of military despotism, the whole labor movement of the city will have been dealt a mortal blow? Union men, brothers, sisters, fellow workers, what are you going to do about it? We appeal to you for solidarity." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Evidently, according to Newsweek, Lindsey Graham has COVID. Lindsey said he feels okay. You know, it would have been much worse had he not been vaccinated. He's been one of the people who was saying, look, you got to go out there and get vaccinated. So he's saying, look, you know, he's you know, he wasn't feeling well. He was diagnosed with it, I guess it was on Sunday is what they're saying. Felt like he had, you know, mild symptoms, you know, like he said, feels like, you know, when someone has a sinus infection. But, you know, he, being an older guy, you know, Lindsey's not a young bird anymore. 66 years old. He's like, you know, could have been much worse. When I saw this story, it got me to thinking, did Lindsey get it with the March for the Taste of Freedom that the House had? Because remember, you had all the children in the House on Friday go marching over. Or, no, it was Thursday. Go marching over to the Senate where they don't have a mask mandate because all of them are vaccinated. And you know, following the rules because they're all on the high risk side of the equation. So you had all the children run over there, rip off their masks, and basically infect the whole area. Did Lindsey get it? Is that where he ended up getting it? Yeah, who knows? Now some good news. The U.S. has hit the highest vaccination pace so far. Evidently, we've hit 70%. And we've had, you know, massive increases because people are finally going, maybe we should do this. And this gives me hope because maybe even the dim are going, yeah, it's free. I don't know anybody who's keeled over from getting the vaccine. And, you know, the story went around that I saw, you know, over the weekend that Trump had done something when he was in office to ensure that the chip was that they're shooting into you is. They're not shooting chips into anybody. But I heard that story. I heard this story that, you know, because of Trump, there's no chip. And if that's what it gets to get you to get the vaccine, by all means. Now, Anthony Fauci on Sunday, Dr. Anthony Fauci, on Sunday warned that, look, we're facing some pain and suffering in the coming months. And he doesn't see another shutdown. And I don't either. I don't see, as a country, we're just not going to do it. It's not going to happen, especially as more people get vaccinated. And it is, like Lindsey Graham, you know, just a sign, you feel like a sinus infection, and it isn't horrible. It's just like the flu, maybe, that you're going to get through it. You're not going to die, but you got to be vaccinated. That's how we beat this. Now, in Florida, evidently, they have hit record number of corona hospitalizations. Evidently, they've got over 10,000 people in hospitals who are confirmed to have COVID-19. This is beat their previous record set back in July of last year. Now, the question is, you know, now that you've hit this record number of hospitalizations, we know that deaths generally tick up soon after that. So are we going to see some of the big numbers coming up? Or are more people going to survive this? And, you know, we'll see, especially as schools are beginning to reopen at the end of the year. This is the amazing thing that's just frustrating to me. With all the numbers coming out of Florida, you had Ron DeSantis Friday say that schools can't make students wear masks when classes reopen next month. And you go, are you not paying attention? Is it that you're just not paying attention, or is it that you just want people to get sick? I mean, I don't get it. And like last week, look, I kind of joked that they're going to turn, you know, Florida and Texas red, or I mean, turn them blue because all the people are going to die. This fortunately isn't that deadly as it was in the past. But here's the thing. We don't know how long you'll suffer from it. As someone told me today, they go, do you know anybody who's had long flu? And I go, I don't know what long flu is. He goes, right. He goes, we know what long COVID is. Long COVID is something that's going to stick with you long after you've no longer had COVID. And, you know, it's kind of like when you have pneumonia. You know, you have some scarring in your lungs, just the tissue there. You know, it's kind of almost the same thing. You're going to have effects down the road. So the best treatment, one, don't get it. two, get vaccinated. You see kind of a pattern? Do you see a common thread there? Get vaccinated. Seems simple. Just seems simple. Anyway, going to take a quick break. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back after this.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Biden welcomes the agreement as one that would show the United States can do big things.
$1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill inches forward in divided Senate.
Dead fish everywhere.
Florida Gulf Coast hit with massive red tide. Plus,
we must do better.
Oregon moves ahead with historic clean energy legislation.
All of that history in the making and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The Department of Energy has a sensor array computer analysis capability that can detect in real time the lightning strikes that might set off a blaze.
We have lightning sensor rays? That's awesome. Do we by any chance have anything that can stop climate change? Because I switched to paper straws a year ago and I don't think they're working.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, big news I know for you when it comes to infrastructure, which you've been talking about for many, many years. Maybe it'll now actually happen.
Maybe.
Maybe.
A bipartisan infrastructure deal passed a key procedural hurdle to begin debate in the U.S. Senate. The nearly $1 trillion plan includes $550 billion in new spending over 10 years to improve the nation's aging infrastructure, including significant spending to repair water systems, modernize the electric grid, and build out the first ever national electric vehicle charging network. If the bill ultimately passes, and that is a very big if, it would be one of the most significant long-term investments in nearly a century. On the Senate floor on Wednesday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer vowed to pass both this bill and President Biden's much broader $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation package.
Yeah, the one with all the climate change stuff in it.
I have laid out a two-track strategy on infrastructure, a bipartisan bill focused on traditional brick-and-mortar infrastructure projects, and a budget reconciliation bill, where Democrats plan to make historic investments in American jobs, American families, and efforts to fight climate change.
Politico reports that former President Donald Trump is trying to sabotage the bipartisan deal because Republicans never gave him an infrastructure package.
Because he never actually tried.
Meanwhile, 17 states are under some kind of heat watch or warning, with 30 million Americans likely to see triple-digit temperatures due to the fifth heat dome in just 6 weeks to stall over the country. Some towns in Montana and Wyoming have seen more days above 100 degrees Fahrenheit so far this year than Dallas, Texas. Mm. A new study from Climate Central confirms that since 1970, more than 90% of U.S. cities have seen a big increase in the number of days above 77 degrees Fahrenheit. The researchers remind dog owners that temperatures above 77 degrees also mean pavement surfaces in direct sunlight can get as hot as 125 degrees, creating painful and even dangerous conditions for dogs' paws. They also warn that dogs can experience heat-related illnesses just like people. The observed increase in extreme weather events like heat waves is also reducing the reliability of nuclear power plants. A comprehensive new global analysis of the world's nuclear fleet calculates that extreme weather outages at nuclear plants are occurring nearly 8 times more frequently now than in the 1990s, due in part to heat and drought that limit the availability of cold enough water to cool the reactors.
Yeah, the heat warms the rivers, the lakes, whatever they're using, and that water is not cool enough to keep the nuclear power plant cool.
kind of a problem.
Yeah.
The study also found that hurricanes and typhoons are now a leading cause of nuclear plant outages.
That's chilling.
Florida is grappling with a massive toxic algae bloom that has littered Tampa Bay and about 100 miles of the state's Gulf Coast with dead fish and other marine animals. Red tides naturally occur off the coast of Florida, but scientists say they're now getting bigger, more frequent, and much worse because of pollution and warming ocean temperatures due to man-made climate change.
And don't they normally come later in the year than this one is coming now?
Yes, they do. Finally, some good news. Oregon's Democratic Governor Kate Brown signed into law one of the nation's most ambitious renewable energy plans. Among a number of strong provisions, it tightens the timetable for the state's two major power companies to reach emissions-free electricity and bans the construction and expansion of fossil fuel power plants. It also allocates $50 million in grants for community-based clean energy projects. Governor Kate Brown emphasized environmental justice in a signing ceremony on Tuesday.
The impacts of climate change are not felt equally. In every crisis and every natural disaster, those who already face disparities due to discrimination and racism are hit the hardest. We must do better.
Good. Glad to see action happening at the state level while D.C. dithers. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, when I first saw Sarah Palin's name being thrown around as possibly a Senate candidate in Alaska, I kind of laughed. Is this a joke? Really? But, you know, and look, I find it's amazing that anyone is considering her at all. But to be honest, many are pining for the days when she was the extreme of the GOP. Now she would seem almost like a moderate. That's how far and how fast they have seemed to go off the deep end. Now here, for the folks in Alaska, if you remember the last job you elected her to, she kind of quit on you know, sometime early. Maybe remember that. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. I've asked our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Ney to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
So what do you think of Sarah Palin running for Senate? What do you think that would look like?
Well, let's see. She's kind of, is she leading the pack or trailing the pack? What do you think?
I think she's just wandering around.
I like the opinion piece that where it said Sarah Palin once on the cutting edge of crazy, now trails the pack.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to happen, personally.
Yeah, when we were in Alaska a couple years ago, we went by her house there in Wasilla, hoping to see Russia, and we missed it.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, we couldn't see. We didn't go bother. I'm not that type of person going to go up and knock on the door. Hi, Sarah, you home? But I did want to see if you could see Russia.
Yes, you are. You are that type of person. You might.
I'm not if my wife's with me. No, she would never
she
allow
agrees.
Me.
Your wife agrees.
She keeps me in line.
Okay.
That's why I'm lucky.
There you go.
I think it'd be fun. What the heck? Throw her in there. Let her see if she can rise to the Boebert Green level now. Which I think, as you said, she's following. She's way behind the pack. But I think it'd be fun, what the heck?
Well, Senator Murkowski already has a Trump-backed challenger, you know. There's one out there already.
All right. Well, you know, it'll be fun to see how that goes.
Right.
Wanted to get your thoughts. You know, the big story, obviously, today was the Obama birthday party. We're going to have this giant super spreader event. Everybody upset. That he's having this big shindig. I actually don't care because I would assume everybody going has been vaccinated. I assume they're going to have some social distancing going on. I don't really care about the party, and to be honest, I don't really care about the people going to the party. But I'm curious your thoughts.
I mean, I don't think it's the end of the world thing. Here's, I think, the saving grace of it. You know, they're going to have it outside. Again, I think they're going to be pretty careful about, you know, who has been vaccinated and who's, you know, coming to the party. And there were political, look, during the whole COVID thing, there were rallies, there were campaign events. You know, Trump had them. Other people had them. So I think now, just because of the Delta variant, probably makes this a story. Otherwise, I don't think it, you know, would have been a story at all.
Right. And now, you know, with Lindsey Graham coming out and saying, look, he got COVID. He had the vaccine. It was just, for him, it was just like a sinus infection. He's fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's the other thing, too. I mean, people have, how many people that have had the vaccination have now gotten COVID? And when I ask that as a question, where they need to be careful about this, because they're almost making it the, you know, the standard that, well, you know, everybody that got vaccinated has gotten COVID. It's still better to get vaccinated. And most people who have been vaccinated don't have COVID.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, my first response to Obama's party was, I don't really care. You know, doesn't matter to me at all. He's a rich guy living in Martha's Vineyard in a $12 million house that I can never afford. I can't even afford to clean it, let alone own it. And he's going to be around a bunch of other rich people, and you know they've all been vaccinated.
I don't care
about them. What I do care about, though, is the messaging that comes out of the politicos, you know, going to this event while they left, while Congress left and did nothing on the foreclosure or the eviction moratorium. That to me is a big deal, and something I wanted to get your thought on, because you're someone who, you know, who does a lot in the real estate buying and selling stuff.
Right.
This is a kind of a big deal in my view.
I think it's a real big deal because there is something I think going to be going on that I think is horrifically dangerous to the average person and especially to people of low income. There are corporations right now as we speak who are thinking about buying single-family homes because they believe that people working out of their homes is now going to be a permanent situation. So the corporations are looking at putting their money together to buy these single-family homes to rent them. And, you know, with the moratorium and people out, you know, of the properties, and all of a sudden the corporations will go in. And by the way, there's a story on this today, I think, in the Washington Post. So it's not just something I'm, you know, conjuring up out of my mind.
No, this is something we had talked about. I had talked about a month ago.
This is
not new. There are a bunch of these big hedge funds who are sucking up these single family homes.
So I think it's extremely dangerous, and this is all coming at once. And so it could put a terrible shockwave into the system and leave people out on the streets. What are they going to do? It will impact the economy, you know, for those people. And other people aren't going to be, quote, getting a break because all of a sudden they have a place to rent. The rents are going to jack up as soon as they're out.
Yep.
That's what's going to happen. And these articles about the corporations buying these properties is it's a really bad thing. I think this is something that shocked me. I mean, it was the blame game in the articles today. You know, everybody blaming everybody else on it. But it surprised me that this is happening. It also surprised me that the CDC makes the decision. The Center for Disease Control, why do they make the decision on this?
I just asked that question earlier.
I don't get it.
I don't know how they have the authority to do that. Isn't that Congress's job?
Well, it sure is. They were given the ability to do it, and I guess from what I read in the article, I'm seeing that they then didn't make a decision a second or third time, and then it falls into the lap of Congress. Now, what genius came up with this whole mechanism to do this is obviously somebody that doesn't understand housing, families, and living. I think it's a terrible way they put this together.
No, it's crazy. And, you know, because we had talked about these hedge funds, you know, buying up these homes.
Right.
And then basically, you know, the take that I had on it, and you can agree or disagree, is that this is the reemergence of the company town. You're going to have company housing again. Right. We're moving into a way of healthcare getting harder to get and more of the company healthcare. It's just another way that corporate America has really got you by the short hairs. And it's one of the reasons, quite frankly, that when my daughter decided she wanted to move out on her own, that my wife and I bought a house for her to rent from us. So that she would have secure housing at an affordable rate, because the rents are today just going through the roof. And, our concern was, is she going to be able to afford a rent, going forward, especially now, as you point out, that you got these big hedge funds buying stuff up?
Well, here's the bottom line. If corporations, for example, were getting together and they were building new homes, and making money out of the development projects, et cetera, and then selling them, that would probably, Rick, bring prices and rents down.
Correct.
To a certain amount.
The new Levittown.
Right, exactly. But if these hedge funds are buying the existing properties that would in other ways be sold to the individuals like we do, like we fix up a house, we buy it, we flip it, we sell it to an individual. But if we're flipping these houses and the corporations are buying them, that will not bring the prices down. Throw in the moratorium ending on the evictions, and then all of a sudden the landlords are like, okay, I'll just sell that property to the corporate entity. Then there goes the property for the renter. It's gone. That was evicted. Where else are they going to move into? And all of a sudden these become corporate purchases, and they'll be corporately controlled.
Yep.
I mean,
And you see these infomercials at 3. Anytime you want to see the horrible stuff that's going to happen, stay up till about 3 in the morning and watch the infomercials that pop up or the commercials that pop up of, so-and-so buys houses. We'll buy your house, crack cash. Those are all, from what I understand, those are all front groups for these big hedge funds where they'll come in, they'll buy your house up cash. And there are a bunch of schemes that go along with this where you think, hey, I'm getting a deal, where ultimately they're just... they're just taking over.
Right. And today the home ownership is just about, I think, over 65%. And then after the Great Recession, as we call it, hedge funds and those private equity firms started buying up single-family homes and using them as rentals. That was a history back when we had the recession.
Right.
This isn't the first time it's happened. I think it's a very dangerous trend.
No, and you're right.
Again, you throw in the moratoriums. Now they've got a whole market they're going to run in and buy.
And that's where my was going. They learned the lesson from the last time, which is don't let the stuff go empty. Go buy it up and keep renting it back to poor people. I see that happening now because, as I had talked with, one of our local state senators here, I said, look, at the end of the day, we're talking about, helping the renter stay in the place. But what's stopping the banks from foreclosing on the landlords who might not be able to pay because they haven't gotten rent in months? And there's, from what I understand, nothing to help protect them. So you get these scenarios where now you have desperate landlords going, hey, I got to get out from under this. And, sure. They're prime for these hedge funds. Not that
Absolutely.
I care about slumlords all that much. But, the system doesn't function if you do away with all of them.
Well, I saw firsthand a property in Columbus, Ohio, and it was selling for about $179,000, and it was bought by an investor group. And I thought to myself at the time, this was a year ago, I thought, who buys $179,000 finished house as an investor group? Who does that? Normally, if you tell me they're building a house, that's one thing. If you tell me that they're buying a dilapidated house and fixing it, that's another. But who buys that, and what's the rationale behind it? So it was going on a year ago.
Yeah, none of this stuff is new. It's the smart people figuring out how they're going to stick it to the rest of us. And look, we have laws that allow them to do it because evidently we decided it was important to go on vacation for 6 weeks while not figuring out how to make sure people are taken care of. Was this do you think this is a big mistake? Because I think going on vacation, taking this 6 week break, I think this was a huge mistake. I think the messaging coming out of the Obama party is not good. But you're the political analyst. Thoughts?
I think the party, I think it was a bad time to have a high-profile party, okay? I don't think it's the end of the world, but I think it was a bad time to have a high-profile party right in the middle of all of this, you know, going on. They're on high rent property, and all of a sudden we're talking about people, you know, being evicted. So you know, you could look at that. Now, is anybody going to lose an election over it? No, obviously it won't be tagged to other people. But I think that with the infrastructure bill, with the moratorium issue, and you know, some other issues with the COVID increasing with the Delta variant, it would have been a good time for them to, I think, do a few more things, obviously, in D.C. instead of heading out.
Yeah, just terrible, terrible stuff. I saw this story coming out of Germany. Evidently, a hundred year old alleged former Nazi guard is being tried as you know, being complicit in the murder of 3,518 people. He's 100 years old.
Wow.
I'm going, you know, kind of late to go after him, but I guess still alive. Thoughts?
Oh, the theory has always been, and the Israelis have been the best at it, that you go after every single person that was out there if they had some kind of complicity in murders. And so I think no matter what the age, they'll go after it to show that, you know, they don't want it happening again, and they won't tolerate anybody around that was part of it.
Yeah, evidently the court there has deemed him mentally fit to stand trial. He can appear in court 2.5 hours a day, and they're going to actually move forward, which made me start to think about, I don't actually remember the resolution, because I was in Cleveland at the time that the Demjanjuk thing was going on. I don't actually remember the resolution of any of that.
Well, Jim Traficant, the late congressman, had fought that, I think, for years. And Demjanjuk was a steel worker, I think.
No, he was an auto worker.
And Congressman Traficant fought that. And then eventually, I believe that he was deported and was taken to trial.
Yeah, I don't remember. Because we moved to Pennsylvania right around that time, and I kind of lost track of it.
Right.
But I guess this could be the last one, and then maybe...
Well, you're one of the last ones. But yeah, the feeling always has been, and Israel has always felt very strong that, you know, no matter what, no matter their age or whatever, if they were complicit in it, and in this case, I think it was like, I don't know, almost 3,000 murders, they're saying, he was involved with, so they will go after him. Not much time probably left on the clock for him.
Yeah. Well, I hope for his sake he was one of them, and I hope they hold him to justice.
Bring justice.
But Bob, I appreciate the time as always. Good stuff.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break right here, right back to wrap things up. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1939. That was the day that the Hatch Act was enacted. The law was named after Senator Carl Hatch, a Democratic senator from New Mexico. The Hatch Act limits political activities by federal employees. One of the reasons the law was passed was due to allegations of corruption by the Works Progress Administration. The WPA was a key program of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal plan to put people back to work during the Great Depression. But critics of the WPA alleged that the program was being used as a form of political patronage, and that the jobs were exchanged as a way to secure votes for the Democratic Party. Although an investigation found no conclusive proof of the allegations, Congress decided to act to define what was appropriate political engagement for a federal employee. Except for the president and the vice president, all federal employees and employees of the District of Columbia must follow the Hatch Act guidelines.
Under the act, federal employees cannot use the authority of their job to interfere with an election. They cannot be a candidate to a public office in a partisan election. They cannot participate in political activity while at work or while wearing a government uniform or driving a government vehicle. But the Hatch Act does not completely stop federal employees from participating in our political system. If they are off the clock, federal employees can still attend political rallies, contribute money to candidates, campaign for candidates, and help register voters. Ensuring the individual rights of free speech and elections free of corruption can be a difficult balancing act, especially for the thousands who call Uncle Sam their boss. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Interesting story coming out of Mexico. Evidently, the Mexican president, Lopez Obrador, he is looking to basically ban, phase out imports of glyphosate. And genetically modified corn. And some are saying, look, you know, the fact that, you know, they're looking to do that since, you know, all of the U.S. corn is with this glyphosate, which is basically that Roundup stuff, that Monsanto, now Bayer, the German chemical company Bayer now owns. Mexico saying, look, we're gonna phase this stuff out by 2024. Why this is important is I think the way the story goes is we export, like, you know, 25% of our exports in corn to Mexico. So this is a huge thing. This is a big deal. In fact, they say that nearly all of the 16 million tons of corn that Mexico imports every year is used for, you know, for their livestock, for their industrial stuff, you know, food plants, stuff like that. The corn that people eat is still domestically produced, but the numbers are huge. It's like a $2.7 billion industry. And what they think and what could possibly happen is they could restore their farming economy. Because if you remember, back when NAFTA was passed, the Mexican government actually had to change their constitution and basically steal land away from their citizens. And then you basically opened the doors and U.S. agriculture just flooded. You couldn't buy the seeds or the, you know, the basic things to plant the corn for what you could get finished product from the U.S. And it just put millions of people out of work. And they were pushed to the maquiladoras on the northern border and then ultimately into the U.S. They're saying, you know, maybe this is how we keep people at home. You give them jobs, and I've been saying this since NAFTA. People want to stay home. They don't want to come to the U.S., but they got to feed their families. Maybe this is a way of doing that. Now, you know, U.S. big agriculture is going to scream bloody murder. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, especially with the new USMCA that was passed during the Trump year. So I'm watching with some interested eye. But we'll see where that takes us. I thought it was interesting that they're moving away from the chemicals and the genetically modified stuff. Maybe we could move away from some of the chemicals. Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com.
Until next time, this has been the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.